Welcome to podcasts on 101.5 FM. From hunting game on African savannas to cooking at sea on naval destroyers and luxury yachts, Klaus Modersitzki has mastered kitchens most chefs never imagine. Then, a completely different pathway. You start teaching everyone from high school students to prison inmates. Your journey proves that great food and second chances can happen anywhere. Klaus, how, when, and where did this ongoing adventure that is your life begin?
It started when I was 12 years old and my mom taught me the first time how to cook. And that's where my love for cooking started. And I always knew I want to be a chef, but I just not want to be a chef in a hotel. I want to be on the ship to see the world, see different people, experience different cultures and different food.
Now, somewhere along the line, we've heard that you were a chef on safari in the savannah of Africa. Talk about that.
Yes, I was approached from a safari company because they had a tour of Germans who didn't speak a lot of English. So they asked me if I want to come for a week and cook for the people, take them on tours, explain what's happening in the bush. And so I did. But the most exciting thing about this was because I had to shoot and cook and prepare my own meat. And that we got from the bush.
That's not easy to do either, is it? You know, you would have had to learn butchering skills, or you taught yourself.
I was a trained butcher before I started to become a chef, so it was quite an easy job for me to slaughter an animal, cut him up, and then prepare it for the guests.
How difficult is that, though, on safari compared with being in a hotel?
Firstly, we had to build a camp, and there was always a little kitchen, and we had a generator with a fridge where we could keep the meat. We had gas bottles to cook with, and I always had one African person helping with me, and I was teaching him on the sideline, and he was teaching me about the animals, the bush, and how to cook in a different way, the way the Africans did.
Well, and what's that? Let's explore that a bit more. How was that? Was it over coals or over fire or...?
One of the food we would season and cover them with clay and put them in the oven or in the fire. And when after about 2 hours, the clay became hard and the food was cooked inside, and we cracked the clay open and then we served the food.
Okay. And was it then tender?
Yes, it was tender. It depends on the meat. We probably used the better tender cuts because the tough cuts we used to cook in these big black pots on the fire for stews.
Because I've lived in Kenya and Somalia, and you know, game is not necessarily a tender meat. I've had warthog that's been as tough as boots. Everything we had to cut a slow cook.
Yes, there were some parts we could grill and some parts we had to cook, and some of them we would hang a little bit longer so they tenderize. We salt them and cover them up with a hessian cloth, and then because we had a couple of days in the safari, so we had time to use the meat and later on.
Did you find that the vegetation that maybe say kudu ate, acacia leaves, that it was it flavored the meat?
Yes, that's true. Some of the herbs and plants in the bush, they have a specific flavor, and if the animals eat it, sometimes you can taste it out. Like in the Karoo in South Africa, the Karoo lamb is very famous because they eat the rooibos, where they also make the rooibos tea.
It's tea, yes.
And you can actually taste the flavor.
Ah, okay. That's interesting. So going on to, I mean, life is tough in those countries, isn't it? You know, I can remember in Somalia, just my kids being so excited about getting an orange in their Christmas stocking, because you just didn't get those things in Somalia, you know, at all.
Yeah, some of the stuff when I did safari cooking, I had to bring with, and I always made a menu before, so I knew what I'm going to cook at that day, and then I just have to supplement the meat, and sometimes even to the local market to buy the vegetable from the Africans on the right of the side of the road.
Yes, and the eggs. Remember, buying eggs, you'd always have to put them into a bucket of water. Those that rose and floated, you just didn't eat those at all.
Yeah.
It was a lot of different things. So from safaris in Africa, you were also then a chef on a yacht in the West Indies. Now, that sounds very glamorous.
Yes, it was. It was one of the best part of my life, where I had the chance to work on a yacht and a chef. And my duty was to look after the customers and the crew. I had to go to the markets and buy the food. Sometimes I went fishing myself, spear gunning and collect the food. One time we even shot a wild goat on an island and a wild pig, and I took it back to the ship and I cooked the food. We collected bananas and coconuts in the bush and collect shells on the beach. We picked up lobsters on the rocks. So it was very interesting and exciting.
So were the guests very demanding at all?
No, they knew, because it was a ship where you know you can't get everything like you get in a hotel. So this was more adventurous trips we made. We showed the people different islands. We showed them how to dive. We had a little dinghy where we used to teach them a bit how to sail. And it was very, I won't say primitive, it was very relaxed, easygoing. So the customer knew what they will expect. They weren't expecting too much.
Okay. No, it sounds a bit different from my kind of Central American experience where we lived in Costa Rica. I had two children under five, and we lived about 10 metres from a crocodile-infested river with a big steep bank. How we survived, I do not know. But anyway, you mentioned earlier you were on a German destroyer for 4 years. So what was the difference in the culture between the German destroyer and a luxury yacht in West Indies? So one's a very military precision, the other one's...
Firstly, the number of people you have to cook for. On the destroyer, we had 350 member of crew, and we had the officer mess, we had the chief mess, and for the crew. And we had 8 chefs on the ship. We had a big kitchen, we had a little baker shop, and one of our chefs was a baker, and he used to work only at night to bake bread and rolls and cakes for the next day, where the other crew members from the kitchen, they would do breakfast and lunch and dinner. But the baker always needed one person to help him in the kitchen. So I said to the chief chef, I would like to work with the baker. I want to learn how to bake bread and rolls. That's what I did for a while as well, and I really enjoyed it. It's quite different from working on a ship, especially when you have a bit of a rough sea and you put the eggs on the grill and the board tips and the egg floats on the grill to the other side.
Yes.
So we had some challenges, but we managed.
You didn't have any kind of dramas on the high seas at all?
At one time it was so bad we had to actually close the kitchen for hot food, and we just made sandwich for the crew. Stacks of sandwich, so we had to bake double bread, and we had to get the food into the places because we couldn't go all into the galley to eat there. So it was a challenge at that time when we couldn't cook because of the rough sea.
You didn't get seasick at all, obviously.
Sometimes depends if you were on land the night before and you had a couple of rum, Bacardi and Coke, and you had a rough sea. Sometimes the stomach wouldn't hold. Yeah.
So how long were you on the destroyer for a period of time?
The first time it was nearly a year.
Without going on land?
Yes, we were actually in America and traveled the East Coast right down to the West Indies. We did some training in Cuba, in Puerto Rico, and then we came back to Boston and then back to Germany. And we did this trip every year for about 6-7 months. And I was lucky to be on that ship for all that time.
Yeah, wow. And then after all that adventure, you tone your life down a notch and find yourself in Australia, in Queensland, and in Caboolture, teaching at TAFE and cooking at a high school and at Woodford Prison. What was this, your midlife crisis, Clark?
No, I don't think it was a midlife crisis. I always never wanted to do one job too long because it was getting bored, and I wanted to do always something new, learn something new, meet new people into different environments, especially kitchen, because there are so many different ways a kitchen are operated, and demand from the customers are different. In a 5-star hotel, it's different to a restaurant or fish and chip shop. Once I worked in Noosa for 9 months in Annabella restaurant in Hastings Street, and there was high-class food, and I really enjoyed it living there. And then I worked in a pub where they wanted simple food, which I couldn't do as well. And then I worked in the Royal Brisbane Hospital as a diet chef for the patients, which I also had to do a course to learn. But then the food in the prison was totally different again.
Well, I'm really intrigued by the prison saga. I mean, how does food impact on inmate morale and behaviour?
Firstly, the food has to be tasteful. It has to be, there have to be enough for them to eat.
So is it sort of kind of simple food, or is it, you know,
no, I won't say simple, but simplified food, maybe, okay. I would say.
What's an example?
Because it's bulk food, and when you cook for 1,200 to 1,400 prisoners, you can't cook little things and the little things there. You have to think bulk food. You have the massive of food, massive of herbs, and you have big pots, and you have different techniques you have to use to make this food palatable and tasteful.
It's a unique challenge, isn't it? I mean, all kitchens are, commercial kitchens are tricky areas, I think. But I can imagine that working in a prison with knives and having inmates, training inmates, could be a pretty tricky situation.
In the beginning, it was a bit daunting, and I was expecting something, and I was always very careful. But we were always worked with teams, so we looked after each other. We had a security guard in the kitchen as well, looked after us while we were teaching and while we were cooking, while we were organizing, making menus, getting stock in, teaching the prisoner how to put the old fruit in the front, the new fruit in the back, in the storeroom, in the fridges, deep freeze. And sometimes you were not really thinking, oh, I work in a prison, I have to be careful. We had a job to do. We had certain times, we had certain resources, and we had certain equipment to do it. And with that one, we had to manage.
And all those skills, they're life skills for those people to take out into the real world as well, aren't they?
That was an aim for me when I walked into this kitchen, said, I will give these people something they can maybe use outside and maybe start a flame in somebody, the love for cooking. And because I explained them a lot, I showed them a lot, I even helped them with their own food to prepare it, make it tasteful, make it look good. And maybe some, when they left the prison, they went and worked in a restaurants or in a...
There's kind of instances. So I think there's a chef called John Watts who was, this may have been in the UK. He was in youth detention for about 6.5 years. And like your situation out there, the cooking inflamed a passion in him. And he went on to become a professional chef and ended up by working for Jamie Oliver, became a TV, you know, chef and all sorts of things. So it's something that you can really work on, I think. I think in Italy as well, I read where 70% of the inmates in Italian prisons, once they're released, recommit a crime. But those that were in the kitchen was only 5%. So kitchen rules, hey?
Yes. Yes, now, I really enjoyed my work in the kitchen there.
Now, you also had a very special recipe that you wanted to share with our listeners as well. And there's a little bit of a backstory to it as well that you want to tell us.
Yes, the recipe is for cheese muffins, and it belonged to my wife's great-grandmother. She was from South Africa, and she handed this recipe over to her mother, to my wife's mother. My wife passed it on to me and to my daughter, and it's a very, very good recipe, and I want to have the chance for all your listeners to have this.
All right. Would you like to read it out then, and we can for them?
And it's very simple. You take 1 cup of flour, 1 cup grated cheese, and 1 cup of milk, 1 tablespoon melted butter, 1 tablespoon of mustard, 1 egg, a bit of salt and pepper, and 2 teaspoons of baking powder. Now you mix all the things together, and when you don't overmix it, and when you take a spoon out of the bowl and you drop it, it must just come off the spoon back into the bowl. Then you preheat the oven, 200 degrees, grease them up in pan, fill them up 3/4, and bake them for 15 to 20 minutes to golden brown. I also got a variation. If you want something with herbs, you can put 2 tablespoons of fresh herbs or a bit of chopped bacon and ham. For the fish lovers, you can put 2 tablespoons of fine tuna flakes and 1 tablespoon of chopped dill. Cool it on a rack and eat it with little butter. Enjoy it.
Oh, for someone who hasn't had breakfast, that sounds pretty good. And I'd have a lot of butter on it, I think. Klaus, what a life. I think you've made the most of every minute of it count. Thank you for joining us. And listeners, if you've enjoyed listening to the story of our seasoned chef, get the pun, and travellers, take a peek at the other tales here. You'll find local business advice from local experts, chats from health professionals, talks from everyone from support groups to historians and sports commentators, all that and more on 101.5fm.com.au.